This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Transfixed by news of riots, mass burials, and fear of disease, another relentless force continues. On May 27, it was 98 degrees Fahrenheit, or about 37 degrees C, in Montreal, Canada. The average high for that time of year is 70 Fahrenheit, or 21 degrees C. The province of Quebec has Canada's highest number of COVID-19 cases, over 50,000 people tested positive, and about 4,500 deaths so far. Their economy has more or less closed down. But every stage and every drama has its backdrop, its scenes. For our times, that is climate change. We may find a vaccine for the new coronavirus. A new business landscape may form. But a hotter world is certain. Extreme weather is the new violence running behind the news and not reported. Because of the pandemic, the United Nations has called off the World Climate Summit for this year. It was supposed to be in Scotland in December. They did not even try to make it a virtual gathering, a move that should have been made years ago. Instead of diplomats, scientists, activists, and the media, thousands of people all flying in from all over the world, some of them in private planes, the COP climate conference system needs to take its own medicine and ditch air travel. I guess we can just postpone climate action for another year, huh? Except dealing with climate is just like the pandemic. Earlier action can save millions of lives. Each year of delay brings the onset of calamity that much closer. It becomes harder and harder to put out the fire. That is why you and I keep the climate watch, no matter what, on Radio EcoShock. But if you need an escape, let's go way out there to the front lines, to a place you won't see in the news. Dr. Simon Quilty serves patients in one of the hottest places on Earth, Northern Australia. Just last year, his patients in Katherine, Australia, suffered through 54 days where temperatures were above 40 degrees C or 104 Fahrenheit, above that. Dr. Quilty estimates during hot weather, about half the people admitted to hospital were pushed over the edge by heat, and some die. But on death certificates around the world, there is nowhere to record heat as a contributing factor like that. We know tens of thousands can die in a single heat wave, like the one that hit Europe in 2003. We know more people will die as global warming delivers even more record temperatures. But we don't know how many, because for a variety of reasons, we don't really count heat deaths. From Alice Springs, Australia, Simon Quilty, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much, Alex.
Just to set the stage here, as a kid I watched a TV show filmed in Australia called The Flying Doctors, and it kept coming back, a new version in 1985, and then in 2008, Bush Doctors, a reality TV series. Simon, have you been a flying doctor for remote communities?
Yes, Alex, I have. I've working in a place like Katherine in the Northern Territory. So Katherine region is the size of France, and it only has 10,000 people living in one town, and then mainly Aboriginal people living in extremely remote communities. The only way to get around effectively is by aeroplane, and I must confess that some of the most scariest moments of my life have been flying through huge tropical storms in 40-year-old aircraft. It's definitely a lot of fun.
Sounds like some of the exciting bush flights that happen here on the coast of British Columbia, where the weather can change on a dime. So I think, Simon, some parts of Northern Australia may be like a lab where we can study extreme heat coming to most of the rest of the world due to our greenhouse gas emissions. What do the patients you see complain of as they arrive during periods of very high heat?
Yeah, well, look, let me firstly set the scene of where my patients come from. So I've described that it's in the tropics. If you watched Crocodile Dundee, that's the country that was that movie was actually filmed in. And in fact, a lot of the scenes were in and around the township of Katherine. So it's incredibly hot, and there's a lot of poverty. Aboriginal people are incredibly left behind financially, economically, socially and culturally. And I guess your suggestion that we use, that it could potentially be a laboratory is a really interesting way to frame how I see the problem. So a lot of the research that's been done around heat and death has been done in subtropical and temperate regions. And there's 2 billion people living in the tropics of the world. And one of the interesting opportunities of understanding heat in a region like the Northern Territory of Australia is that it is a high resource setting with incredibly impoverished people. So we have access to some really fascinating data that can really help us understand how people are dying from the heat. But going back to your question, what do the patients complain of in this extremely hot weather? So as a doctor, what I see regularly is extreme heat really driving people into hospital in waves. So in the tropics of North Australia, the environment is divided into seasons where we have the hot wet season where it rains a lot, and then we have the cooler dry season. So we don't have heat waves so much as heat seasons. And in the hot weather, we refer to it as mango madness or going tropo. It's a really intense period where the heat starts to affect biology and behaviour. And so in terms of the biology of how this heat impacts people, it decompensates particular diseases. It also transforms the whole ecosystem. So, for instance, the crocodile attack victims that I've treated have been treated at times of hot weather. The snakes are more active. So it becomes quite a crazy season. And when you work in a hospital that's in a non-tropical environment, you get used to this tempo of work that is the same throughout the year. And maybe when in the colder weather, you get more influenza and respiratory illness. But the tempo of tropics is very distinct. It's the hot and wet weather and the dry weather, and it really flavours everything about the work as a doctor that I do.
In November 2017, Radio EcoShock guest Camilo Mora described his paper titled 27 Ways a Heat Wave Can Kill You. So it's not just heat stroke or sunburn or something. Talk to us about the processes you see where heat drives other existing conditions into hospitalization or even death.
So, Alex, obviously, for anyone that's visited the tropics, you'll understand that heat can kill directly. And so when you live in a place like Castoran, you realise that you can only spend about 15 minutes out in the sun in the middle of the day before you can feel your whole body decompensating. And that's somebody that's fit and well. But in terms of the processes that are more likely to kill people, so when you live in a tropical environment, everybody is very well aware, and even parking your car and walking to the shops can be a bit of an ordeal. But if you have underlying health conditions, then they can absolutely be decompensated by that walk through the heat to the shops. So cardiac failure, you can imagine your heart's pumping. If it's not pumping as well as it should do, then that heat stress will make you evaporate more. It'll mean that your heart has to pump harder. And a lot of the medications that we use carefully balance the fluid inside people. And when you get a really hot period, that can push you over the edge. Really extended periods of extreme heat can damage kidneys. And really interestingly, I'm working on some research at the moment that's demonstrating that it has a very significant impact on mental health. So you can imagine, particularly for Aboriginal people, that but all people in the Northern Territory, it turns out, the chances of taking your own life and committing suicide in extremely hot weather doubles compared to cooler weather. And we're in the process of trying to prove exactly what this association means. But you live in the tropics and you don't have good resources to shield yourself from environmental extremes. Hot weather can really precipitate impulsive behaviour. One of the things that I've noticed as Aboriginal people come to terms with the extreme impact of climate change on their environment is possibly also an existential grief as they see the environment destroyed by climate change and they have no power in which to respond to that. So heat can affect people in many ways, in a biological and psychological capacity.
Yes, you see, I think you are teaching us something about the future of the world as we warm. And you've just talked about the mental health impacts and the feeling of grief as we lose this environment. It's horrible, but it's inspiring because now we can see what is coming.
Well, yeah, Alex, so you did point out that issue of using the Northern Territory like a lab, and that's entirely my intention over the next few decades. This problem is not going to go away. So, for instance, in your introduction, you described that we had 54 days above 104 degrees Fahrenheit. Over the last two decades, the temperature in the Northern Territory has increased on average by 2 degrees Celsius, and inland Central Australia is increasing at the most rapid rate of all. The long-term average of days above 104 degrees Fahrenheit, which is 40 degrees Celsius in Australia, is 6. And last year we had 54 days above 40 degrees Celsius. And this is the new norm, but only for a short period because it's going to get much worse as the climate heats. So the only thing that we can do is understand it as best we can to learn how we can adapt and certainly how we can mitigate, which is the absolute imperative at the moment.
Dr. Mora also told us about the harvest effect, where the deaths come in days or even weeks after the heat wave. Does Australia have a heat warning system for outdoor workers like farmers to avoid exposure during heat events?
I haven't read Dr. Mora's research, but what she's talking about is what I would term a lag effect. And the international academic literature tends to suggest that there's not a lag effect from heat so much as cold. However, I think most of these academics live in southern or further northern climates that are cooler than where I live in Central Australia. And there's no doubt that there's a lag effect. And I'll put it this way. So one of the fascinating things about the north of Australia is its ancient Indigenous people. There's over 40 different languages still spoken today by Aboriginal people that have had connection with the land for 60,000 years, and colonisation has been quite cruel to these people. And so you can imagine nowadays they are now experiencing heat that has never been experienced before, and the infrastructure that they have is meagre and it was inappropriate 20 or 30 years ago when it was built, and it's simply not prepared for these new climate extremes. So you can imagine if you have a period of 21 days above 104 degrees Fahrenheit, which we had last year, your building starts to warm up, your air conditioning costs skyrocket. When you don't have much money, you run out of power cards to keep the air conditioning going, and you experience a blackout and power failure because of your economic stress. All of the contents of your fridge go off, and this is by day 5. And so what you suddenly have is a competition between energy security to cool your environment down and your refrigeration and food security. And there is no doubt that there's a lag effect with heat, and we have a lot of work to do. So your question was, does Australia have a heatwave warning system? This is a state-by-state basis. In the Northern Territory, we do not have a heatwave warning system, and there's a real problem here. Because we live in a tropical environment, it's already been estimated by academics that up to 75% of days in the Northern Territory, it is inappropriate to work outside. The Northern Territory has the greatest outdoor workforce of any state in Australia. And so having a heatwave warning system is extremely problematic.
Right. Every day is going to be hot for a long period of the year. Now, with lead author Thomas Longdon, you just published a paper in the prestigious journal, the medical journal, The Lancet. And the title is Heat-Related Mortality, an Urgent Need to Recognize and Record. But why don't we begin with Tom Longdon's earlier work in the Climatic Change Journal in September 2019. What did Dr. Longdon provide that helps track real heat deaths?
Yeah, so there's some very complex epidemiology and statistics, and I'll brush past them by saying that basically we understand that on stable temperature days, we have a standard death rate. And what we know is that as the heat goes up, so does the death rate. So between, say, 20 and 25 degrees Celsius for most parts of the world is when we experience the least deaths. And what we do know is really cold climates, like the north of America and Europe, when it is really cold, you do experience an increase in death. But for the 2 billion people in the tropics, and this has been the focus of attention and what Tom Longan really argued against in his paper in 2019, it's not cold weather in the tropics that kills people, it's the hot weather. And so Tom has done some very, very sophisticated modelling that shows that heat-attributable death is really much higher in countries like Australia than previous mechanisms and approaches to modelling suggested. So it was really important research that highlighted the dire consequences of heat, particularly for the 2 billion people that live in the tropics.
So when it comes to heat deaths in Australia, what is the official number of people dying due to heat according to the count of death certificates?
So in our recently published paper in The Lancet, we looked at all deaths between 2006 and 2017. There were 1.7 million deaths, and of those deaths, only 300 people were recorded to have died as a direct result of heat, and another approximately 300 people associated with heat. So less than 1,000 people were recorded on the formal mechanism of recording death, which is the death certificate, which you have the same process in the US, when in fact our modelling and Tom's modelling suggests that in fact that number is closer to 40,000. So we're only detecting roughly one in every 50 people who are dying from heat. So you can imagine with coronavirus, if we were only detecting one in every 50 cases, we'd be in an awful lot of trouble.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm your host, Alex Smith. Get all our previous programs at our website, ecoshock.org. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest, Dr. Simon Quilty, a practicing specialist physician calling in from Alice Springs in Australia's outback. We're talking about extreme heat hitting Australia as an example of the coming hot world. During this COVID-19 pandemic, we've seen lots of countries find ways to undercount deaths from the virus. In Russia, they only listed people who showed the disease in autopsies, and you can imagine they didn't have time to do a lot of autopsies. And the U.S. didn't count nursing home deaths until recently. And some countries downplayed the disease, so they didn't want the real death count known. Do you suppose that reticence to attribute deaths to heat could be related to government reluctance to admit the seriousness of climate change?
Look, there's no doubt that certainly in the US and Australia, our federal governments are heavily influenced by lobbyists from coal, oil and gas. And our entire economies are built upon coal, oil and gas. And in Australia, that is very much a political reality. However, in this new era of conspiracy theory, I think what is really interesting about the coronavirus is that it is an absolute biological reality. And as scientists and doctors, we not only do we know how to predict that the disease will affect people, but we look after these people in their dying days. There's no argument against reality. And so what we need to start doing very rapidly is recognising the real risk to future generations. And I believe that in the next 20 to 30 years, climate change and global warming is going to make coronavirus look meek in comparison in terms of its impact on humanity.
Yes. Well, perhaps medicine and governments are stuck in this one-dimensional way of thinking. We demand the cause of death rather than the complex ways that bodies do break down and can't recover. Your thoughts on that?
Yeah. So, look, I mean, I think one of the fascinating perspectives that I have working with Indigenous people in the north of Australia is an understanding of human beings as ecological beings. We are part of a complex ecosystem. And one of the problems with the death certification process and the way that governments try and have this one-dimensional way of thinking about death is that it's describable in terms of its organ cause, as if it's removed from the reality of the ecosystem. And certainly, you know, as urban beings, so we forget that we're urban beings, and the Aboriginal people that I work with remind me every day that we are, in fact, ecological beings, but we're withheld in the construct of an urbanised world. And so we're much less likely to recognise that. And it's interesting, you know, when if we count deaths by immersion in water, we call that drowning, and that's very visible and easy to see. But if you start to try and attribute death to heat, it's actually much more complex than that, and it's a hard job to actually define heat-related mortality. But in big part, that is because once a person comes into a hospital, they're in an air-conditioned environment, and we as doctors forget to actually mark down on the death certificate that heat was instrumental in this person's demise.
Simon Quilty, what are you and other Australian doctors recommending as changes to the way deaths are recorded?
So, look, I think across the world it's recognised that the death certification process is very antiquated. It's a piece of paper with a series of catalogue spaces to record how this person demised. In this modern day where we have electronic records, it would be really helpful. You wouldn't necessarily even need to say that heat was attributable. It would be good to record on that electronic piece of paper the amount of air pollution, the temperature and other environmental factors so that we can start to get a grasp and we can start recognising the impact of the environment in terms of human health and well-being.
The other odd thing about official heat mortalities is we can't really use them as a gauge to how much the climate is warming, because in Northern Europe and North America, heat deaths may have decreased somewhat, not because it isn't hotter, but because the authorities reacted to shocking numbers dying, as they did in Chicago in 1995, for example. And they instituted social changes to cope, like cooling centers for the poor and the homeless, and India reduced heat mortalities that way. It kind of hides the real dangers of increasing heat up to a point, doesn't it?
Yeah, so look, I'll give you an example of the real dangers of heat. So in Catherine last year, we had the hottest summer ever on record, and this is over the last decade. There's been two or three summers that are record-breaking, and there's record-breaking weather all of the time. In December, we had a month that was 5 degrees above the long-term average. It was around about 106 degrees Fahrenheit on average for the month. And a whole lot of billabongs dried up. Aboriginal people have ancestral stories that are much more accurate than you might predict. So there's stories, for instance, in far north Queensland of volcanoes erupting, and when geologists have looked at the dates of that last eruption, it was over 20,000 years ago. And so when an Aboriginal person tells me that their water hole has dried up because it's never been so hot ever before, I tend to believe that they will know better than anybody else. And so it's quite possible that in the last summer, we had the hottest summer ever in the last 65,000 years of human habitation in Australia. And that was very clearly demonstrated to me ecologically. So Catherine is obviously a very wild town with nature all around for many, many hundreds, if not thousands of kilometres in any direction. And there's these beautiful big trees along the riverbank called bush apple trees. They're massive trees. They're all hundreds of years old, and they provide all of the green foliage along the river corridor. And last summer, I watched as just about every single tree died along the river corridor that I could see. And it's not through lack of water. These trees have their roots in the riverbank, and the river is permanently full. And so I can only presume that they died as a direct result of an extraordinary heat and unprecedented heat wave that must predate processes of ecological adaptation over the last 60,000 years. And so humans cannot be immune from such massive ecological change.
Simon, why did your team include bushfire deaths in a study about heat mortality?
Well, we feel that a lot of ecological variables that are new and unprecedented are not being recognised for the health harms that they do. And so I'm sure many of your listeners would have heard about the devastating bushfires we had on the East Coast this year. It's truly unfathomable how much of the country actually burned. And across Australia, all the way out into Central Australia, the entire atmosphere went an eerie orange colour. And closer to the bushfires, there was dense, thick smoke throughout cities and towns everywhere. And once again, there's no formal way of recording these deaths. And it's because we are now living in unprecedented times where this stuff hasn't ever been encountered before, and we need to be measuring it.
In addition to the large-scale heat maps employed by Longdon, we also find temperatures much higher within cities, the urban heat island sort of thing, and some of them are never recorded. For example, on Radio EcoShock, we spoke with Dr. Matt Santamouris, and he's a professor of high-performance architecture at the University of New South Wales. And Matt was measuring local heat within cities, and a drone carrying heat-measuring equipment discovered 158 degrees Fahrenheit, 70 degrees C, on an upper-level car park in Darwin. If somebody moves from an air-conditioned office into that kind of heat, could that bring on medical problems, or does it take us a while to soak up and build up our core temperature?
Let me tell you that similar studies have been done in Darwin in children's playgrounds, which have found exactly the same thing. In fact, I think they were even hotter. I've treated people who've had epilepsy and had a seizure and fallen on the ground and had third-degree burns as a result. And for anybody that's walked through a car park when the ambient temperature outside is 49 degrees Celsius, which it reached here in Alice Springs last year, you'll realise that you, from a physiological point of view, there's a very limited time before you will cease to be alive in that kind of temperature.
And we know the world is warming pretty rapidly. What is your team's estimate for the death toll in Australian cities by 2080, well within the lifetimes of young Australians now?
Yeah, look, so CSIRO did some interesting research back in the early 2000s, and they predicted an increase in temperature by 2 degrees in many parts of the Northern Territory by 2030 and up to 7 degrees by 2070. And it's very clear already that these are significantly underestimating the true speed of temperature increase. And so we're already there. We're already at 2030 predictions 10 years early. So I imagine that by the year 2070, we will be seeing temperatures up to 60 degrees Celsius or 130 degrees Fahrenheit, which is, by that stage, you are talking about an uninhabitable space. Air conditioning will not be able to compete with temperatures that are that high. And vast swathes of the Earth will be potentially uninhabitable unless we take urgent action on climate change to reduce carbon emissions and to move towards a carbon-negative economy so that we prevent that from happening. It's impossible to predict under those kind of circumstances how many people will die. Many people will die as a result of migration, homelessness, wars and famines. But if they weren't to happen by some miracle, then you could predict. So we predict that roughly 2% of people die from heat at the moment. I presume from some early data that we will see an exponential rise with every 1 degree in temperature rise of heat waves. And so we could be looking up anywhere above 10 or even 20% heat mortality, particularly in tropical environments.
This is a giant, slow-moving heat pandemic. Did your team extend your analysis to the United States? And if so, what did you find?
We haven't extended to the United States at the moment. I'm just aware that the US and many parts of Europe have similar death certification processes.
Okay, now is there any other message as we wrap up here that you would like to leave with our listeners?
Look, everybody can see that climate change is real. There is some very complex political messaging coming from coal, oil and gas. Climate change is a devastating reality for people in the tropics. It's already arrived. People are already dying from extreme heats that are a direct result of climate change. We're all in this together. We need to unite. We need to change the way we live dramatically, and we need to start recognising that for us to propagate generations into the future, we must take more heed of our commitment and our resolve to care for our planet.
From the front lines of heat in northern Australia, we've been speaking with specialist physician Dr. Simon Quilty. In addition to serving in Northern Hospital, Simon is a visiting lecturer at Australian National University and a fellow of the Royal Australian College of Physicians. Find links for this new paper on the need to recognize and record heat-related mortality in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Simon, thank you for sharing your time with our listeners.
Thanks very much, Alex. Much appreciated.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. As Dr. Quilty mentioned, when outside temperature goes above 120 degrees Fahrenheit or 48 degrees C, air conditioners struggle to keep up, and power bills can become prohibitively expensive. Most AC manufacturers only provide test data to about 120 degrees Fahrenheit. If outside temperatures soar to 130 degrees Fahrenheit or 54 degrees C, the air conditioner will likely overheat and shut itself down. In other words, no, air conditioning cannot protect us from developing extremes of heat on a warming planet. When those temperatures appear for any length of time, humans will have to abandon those places and go live somewhere else, if they can. Otherwise, Dr. Quilty says, 10 or 20% of the population will die from causes driven by the superheat. Air conditioning may prolong our stay, but don't count on machines to save us. Research is ongoing into the mental health impacts of excess heat. We know suicides go up. The data on violent crimes is mixed, especially if it is just too hot to go outside. But we can know how our bodies react to high heat. All of us should learn the signs, our pre-existing risk factors, and all that. Nobody has studied it more thoroughly than Dr. Camilo Mora from the University of Hawaii. Here is a replay of my interview with Dr. Mora, recorded in November 2017. His paper is 27 Ways a Heat Wave Can Kill You, Deadly Heat in the Era of Climate Change.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
You need to hear this interview. We're going to explore new science with a title that is starkly clear, 27 Ways a Heat Wave Can Kill You, Deadly Heat in the Era of Climate Change. In April 2017, I interviewed Dr. Camilo Mora. He led a team of 14 scientists from the University of Hawaii, Manoa. They concluded that somewhere between 2033 and 2070, nothing will be the same in a hotter world. That is when the Earth will get a whole new climate. Humans are already dying, as you know, by the thousands, even by the tens of thousands, in deadly heat waves. We don't know when that may become millions of deaths. In fact, until the work just published by Camilo Mora's team, nobody had studied all the ways our bodies react to excess heat. Camilo Mora is from the Department of Geography at the University of Hawaii, Manoa, where he heads the Mora Lab. From Honolulu, Dr. Mora, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex. A pleasure to be with you again.
Is your new paper a logical question arising from your earlier work on the arrival of a new hot climate?
Yes, and in fact, even after we published the paper that you're talking about, we did a second paper looking at heat waves that had killed people in the past. And what we decided was to investigate how many of them had happened, and we found close to 2,000 cases since 1980 when the conditions got to be too hot and people died. Some of these cases, as you point out, killed up to 70,000 people in a couple of weeks, like the one in Europe in 2003, that heat wave. It's amazing that killed 70,000 people. There was another heat wave in Russia in 2010, and that killed 15,000 people. There was a heat wave in Pakistan and India in the last 2 years that killed 4,000 to 5,000 people. So, and we found on that one paper about close to 2,000 cases, just like that, of people dying around the world because it got to be too hot. Now, after we published that paper, one of the things that was very intriguing to me was the fact that on all of those papers and all of those cases that we reviewed, it was very vague how people died during those heat waves. So everybody knew people die in those days, but why they die? And the reason why that became important to me is because most people is getting the impression that it's only the poor people, the elderly people, the one that had no money to buy an air conditioning, the people that are dying during this heat wave. So we decided to investigate how is it that people is dying, and we ended up reviewing the medical literature. We reviewed a lot of papers about how medically is that you die, and we found that when you put all of those pathways together, there are 27 ways in which you can die during a heat wave, and they can pretty much happen to anybody. So for me, it was just mind-blowing to find that there are so many of them, you know. I just expected to be maybe one or two ways in which you die during these heat waves, but finding out that there were 27 ways, it was just mind-blowing to me, because that just points out the fact that as a human, we are very delicate to heat, and unfortunately, the planet is getting hotter. So you get the combination of two terrible things coming our way.
Well, it is amazing. I mean, we learn a little bit about our basic organs and maybe circulation in school, and then we don't really know how heat is dangerous for us. And what you've just said stimulates another memory in me. In 2008, I broadcast a recorded briefing for congressional staffers about how smog kills. And it was Dr. Joel Schwartz, I think. He was Harvard's top pollution expert. And he said that we don't know how many deaths are caused by smog because the death certificates, they never say that. It's often listed as heart failure or something else. Do you think there's a similar lack of statistics and maybe underestimation of the number of heat deaths?
Oh, big time, big time. I mean, even on the developed world, there is not a sad diagnosis for when you die from a heat wave. Normally, obviously, at the end of the day, when you die from this thing, your heart stops, and most likely the diagnosis is that you had a heart attack. But it turns out that there were all kind of changes happening to your body and damages happening to your body that ultimately make the heart to stop. So obviously, all of that gets clustered within heart attack, and obviously there is a huge underdiagnosis of the number of people dying during these heat waves, because there is just no such a thing as a good diagnosis when people die from heat wave. Now, that's one of the things for the developed world. The things are obviously worse for the developing world. What we found on the paper in April about the heat waves that are killing people is that we found that all of these heat waves that are killing people are happening at mid latitudes, mostly developed countries like the United States, Australia, Japan, Canada, Europe, all developed countries. So for me, that was very intriguing. Is either this heat wave just killing the rich? Now, what we did find was that the climatic conditions that have killed people in those countries, those same climatic conditions are also happening on poor countries. So what that suggests to me was that in developing countries, these heat waves are also killing people. It's just that they don't have the resources to have the good research to find out how many of them are. So, yes, going back to your question where this is being underestimated, I'm confident that this is being underestimated not only on the developed world, but much bigger in the developing world.
Well, let's dig into the very good science in your paper about how our bodies really work when they get overheated. And I'd like to go step by step, Camilo, as you do in your very helpful press release about the paper. I've read the full paper, but that press release really helped me get oriented. And the first process we all experience is that blood flows towards the skin trying to cool us off. But what really happens there that is a risk?
So the risk that comes from when you get overheated, just like when you go for a run and you start overheating, your body starts generating heat and you need to expel the heat. So the body, what it does there is start making the heart pump harder, and it closes blood flow to many organs in a way so that all of the blood now goes to your skin, where it gets cooled down through the process of evaporation of your sweat. So the blood cools down and then it comes back in into your body cooler. Now, the problem when it's hot outside is that the sweat doesn't evaporate, then the blood comes back in hot. So the body makes an extra effort then to send even more blood to your skin as a way for it to cool down. By doing so, what it happens is that it deprives many organs of blood. And that's what is called ischemia. Basically, several organs start being deprived of blood, and what it does is that it creates these anoxic conditions on those organs, right? And when you have a lack of oxygen on those organs, then that creates all kind of chemical reactions there that are detrimental to that organ. The organ that is the most critical, interestingly enough, I found, was the gut. obviously you are hot, you just want to cool down the body, the first organ that it cuts the blood supply to are the gut, because you don't need the gut when it's pretty hot. But unfortunately, if the conditions are very long, the gut, the lining of your intestines breaks, and now all of the things that you had inside your guts leak in into your bloodstream. And what you ended up having is this massive contamination of your body with everything that was in your gut into your bloodstream. And again, all of that, the result of the fact that there was just no blood getting into your guts. And that's one of the mechanisms that we found causes people to die during these heat waves. Basically, your guts just break, and that obviously is a cause for death.
But I had no idea that was happening. So how did you find that out?
Well, it turns out that there are many disciplines that have investigated that quite a lot. Like, for instance, people that do a lot of exercises outdoors, like sport people, military people, mining. These are jobs in which a lot of people have died because of excess heat. So the medical doctors had actually investigated that quite a lot on those cases. And that's how the medical literature is very rich on how people die from heat, because in certain jobs, the medical doctors had actually investigated that quite a lot. Unfortunately, when it comes to heat waves, we just lack the research to study that. But thankfully, we already know that well from other disciplines.
And what is heat cytotoxicity? Did you already cover that?
No. So another thing that happens, obviously the ischemia is one that can kill you. The other one that can kill you as well is what is called heat cytotoxicity. So when the blood comes back in hot, and obviously your body is generating more heat, the temperature of the body gets higher than the optimum temperature, which is roughly 37 degrees Celsius. So if it gets hotter than that, then basically you start cooking yourself. Think about like a sunburn. So many organs start getting damaged, physically damaged, but some other organs can also break. Yeah, but just imagine this like a massive sunburn, and eventually your skin just peels off. So the same thing happens, but now inside your body, and what it does, of course, is that it starts helping the breaking of the membranes that maintain the structure of many of these organs. So the heart, for instance, starts breaking into pieces, and then it doesn't work as good in a moment when you need your heart very bad. So having a sex heat is pretty bad for your heart. It's also terrible for your lungs. Obviously, you start respirating more because you need more oxygen. And with this heat cytotoxicity and you cooking your lungs, the lungs don't work as well. So many people start also suffering from lack of oxygen getting to their bloodstream. And that is what is called heat cytotoxicity, basically the time when the temperature is hotter than what the temperature that can be tolerated by yourself.
Does the immune system get involved?
We didn't find literature on that. We know that there is something called a shock thermal proteins, which is, again, just one response for the body to keep up with that heat. But the or reading of that was that those are processes that normally take time to develop. But as for the immune system itself, we just didn't come across any specific paper talking about it. But that's not to say that they are not.
And then there's blood clots. Really, blood clots are a factor in heating?
Oh, big time. So what happens is when you break the lining of your guts, now the human body realizes that you are getting contaminated. So you have something that is called white blood cells, and they start attacking those contamination bacteria and food that now you have going through your bloodstream. And the way to kill it is just by creating coagulation around it. Right, and now what you ended up having is a potential solution for healing the body turning into a something that can kill you. So that's one mechanism. The other mechanism is that you have these blood clogging proteins that, interestingly enough, are sensitive to heat, so they become overreactive. So everywhere they are, they just create coagulation wherever they are. Now, so that the clogging can kill you, right, because you ended up getting a clog. But the other problem that will happen is the fact that you will start running out of the clogging protein, so that if you had a small cut, you can bleed to death because the body cannot clog it, because you pretty much use all of your resources of those proteins. So those cloggings are actually bad from both ends. They can kill you because they clog the blood, and when you run out of them, the lack of proteins that clog can also kill you, because you can have a danger of dying from an hemorrhage just because there is no clogging proteins left.
But I assume a process like that doesn't happen quickly. I mean, we're talking about a longer exposure to heat before all those systems could interact and kick in?
So that happens. It varies quite a lot, we presume, because there is not really research into this by individual. So there are certain individuals, for instance, the elderly, the isolated, people that is exposed to heat constantly, in which their temperature rises pretty fast, and unfortunately their body doesn't have the capacity to cope with it, so basically cooling down. So imagine of it like running a marathon. Yeah, so you can go and you can select 1,000 people to run a marathon, and most likely 10 of them will finish it. Most of us are just going to finish up. We are probably never going to finish it up. So the same thing goes during this heat wave. So you start stressing the body, and not everybody is going to be able to sustain it. And the extent to which these mechanisms start kicking in depends on how strong really you are at that moment. And, of course, many people is going to get filtered early on, and some of us might endure it at the end. So the answer to your question is that depends, obviously, on how good the body is at the moment when they get exposed to that heat.
But if we go to a sports game, we expect those teams to play, even though it's really, really hot. Although we had a couple of tennis players fall over in Australia, I think it was a couple of years ago, in heat there. Should we be closing games down if it's that hot, or should we even be exercising ourselves?
No. They do that normally. Obviously, doing exercise is not a bad thing, because what happens when you do exercise on a normal day is that the body can sweat and you feel the cooling. In fact, if you are doing massive exercise and you stop for a moment, you start feeling that the sweat starts evaporating, right? That's because the humidity is low and that evaporation cools you down. The problem is when you do that when it's hot, because basically there is no mechanism for the body to cool down. And that's when the thing becomes dangerous. And here in the United States, I have seen multiple times where referees had to stop the game for people to just go and get drink water and cool down a little bit, because it becomes potentially dangerous if you continue to be exposed to that extreme heat while doing exercise.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
You're listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm your host, Alex Smith. My guest from the University of Hawaii is Dr. Camilo Mora. He's the lead author of 27 Ways a Heat Wave Can Kill You, Deadly Heat in the Era of Climate Change. Well, we're just getting started with this heating. We can stay inside with air conditioning, we think, as long as the power's on. But what about the 600 million people in India, for example, who do not have electricity at all? What are their prospects as global warming develops?
Well, first of all, I don't think the air conditioning is really a solution to this problem, yeah? Because imagine, let me just give you an analogy. There is I am a good friend with Mike Tyson, and Mike Tyson every time keep punching me on the face, right? So we're good friends, but every time he just keep punching me on the face. Now, my solution to that problem is to use protective gear on my face so I don't get, when he punched me, I don't feel the pain. Right, so the same analogy goes here with the air conditioning. We had a heat wave that is killing people, and our solution to it is just to buy air conditioning so we don't feel the pain. Personally, I would prefer the solution to be heat waves at all. Just like in the case of my friend Mike Tyson, I would like him not to punch me at all. Yeah. So this idea that we are going to escape these dangers of this heat by buying air conditioning is fair game, but unfortunately, I don't think that's the best solution, because at the end of the day, these heat waves are still going to be just as lethal outside. Now, but you point out a very interesting point, though, which is the fact that many millions, if not billions, of people around the world just don't have the resources and money to buy an air conditioning, much less to pay for the electricity that it will cost. Now, that's for the developing world. Now, for the developed world, the problem is going to be the electrical grids, because during those heat waves, the electrical wires cannot conduct electricity as good because it's pretty hot. To make matters worse, everybody is turning on their air conditioning. So it has been found in multiple cases in the developed world, when these heat waves are happening and everybody turn on their air conditioning, that the whole electrical grid collapses. Yeah, and obviously that becomes a potential death sentence for many people, because you're in the middle of a heat wave and you cannot turn on your air conditioning. And again, that's another argument that I use to suggest that really what we need to do is to prevent these heat waves from happening in the first place.
I'll bet most Americans have forgotten about the Chicago heat wave of 1995. Over 700 people died in 5 days. They parked refrigerator trucks outside the overflowing morgues to hold them. And one factor in Chicago was fear of crime. Seniors died inside their rooms because they were afraid to leave a window open. So I guess social factors can be important in all this, too.
Yes, I mean, that's another big issue for the good and for the bad. Right now, for instance, in the United States, this past summer and the summer before, there were over 100 million Americans that were told to stay indoors because it was too hot outdoors. Yeah, there were warnings by the federal government that say you need to go indoors because the conditions outdoors are pretty lethal. So that's the reason why we are not dying so much. It's just because right now the government is becoming more preventive and people is becoming more aware of this. But again, that doesn't mean that the conditions outdoors are just not as lethal.
Well, we also had an Australian medical expert on the show saying that the nighttime temperatures can be critical, as well as the number of days of heat in a row, because somewhere we need time for the body's core temperature to cool down or we die. Did you encounter that factor in your study?
No. Yes, it is there, but specific information, we found only like maybe one or two papers about it. What makes this situation even more dangerous, especially on tropical places, is the issue of humidity. Right, so during the day, it's pretty hot because the sun is blasting right at you, right? So in places that are humid, obviously that heat evaporates the water. Now, at night, when the sun falls down, you still lack the heat from the sun, but unfortunately, as it gets colder, the humidity goes up because there is less temperature on the air. The temperature is colder. So what happens at night on many of these tropical places is that it's not necessarily the heat as much as it is the high humidity what then heats you at night. So you go from being hot all day long because during the daytime you get the high temperatures of the sun, and at night when there is no high temperatures of the sun, you get the high humidity of the evaporation and you still cannot cool down. So obviously this becomes like an endurance test that many people cannot endure because you just don't get a relief of it, not during the day, not during the night.
We mentioned seniors and people with medical conditions, but as you mentioned in your paper, babies and toddlers are really at risk during a heat wave. Why are their bodies more sensitive?
So on that paper, we actually make the case that this is something that could happen to anybody. Yeah, so obviously there is a much higher risk for this to happen to specific people like the elderly and the young. But that's not to say that healthy people like you or I or any young person is at risk from this. This can happen to even sport people playing outdoors. Now, but answering your question of the children, though, the reason why they are very vulnerable is because of their small bodies. The heat can get to them faster. So they heat up much faster than an adult will do simply because they're small bodies. Think about it, like when you had a big potato and you want to cook it, you put it on the hot water, that big potato is going to take a long time for it to cook. Now, you put a small potato or you cook that potato in half, the big potato in half, that potato is going to cook much faster because the heat can get to the core much faster. So the issue is the same issue with children and with babies. It's the fact because their small body, whenever it's hot outdoors, that heat gets to them much faster than it will do to an adult just because of their size and volume.
Well, I'm sorry to ask this one, but we do need to face up to it. I'm wondering what it might feel like to be dying of heat. Would we even know that we are dying? I mean, we don't know we're at risk. Would we know that it's actually happening to us?
No, and in fact, most of the there is something called harvesting effect when it comes to heat waves, because you might still feel the heat, and these many of these physiological processes can be triggered, but you might not die right away. You know, you can die, for instance, with a broken liver, with a broken kidneys. You can live with that, and unfortunately, the deaths normally happen past the heat wave event, and that's what is called the harvesting effect, in which the mortality associated with these heat waves actually happen a few days, months, and at times years later after the heat wave, just because the organs got so damaged, they can still function, and eventually they will get you. So just going back to your question, it's just not safe to be on hot conditions for a very long period of time because it will trigger these mechanisms. Again, that's just not to be scared of heat, because normally the body has a very good defense to cool down from it. The problem is when you get exposed to it for a very long period of time, which happens during a heat wave, that you get exposed for up to two or three weeks of heat during these heat waves.
Well, you know, so far the world's only warmed about 1 degree C over pre-industrial times, and I'm having a hard time finding any scientist on the show who thinks we won't warm at least another degree during this century, and some say we will hit 3 degrees or more. Camilo Mora, given your study, what does this future look like?
Oh, no, this is not going to look pretty. Right now, this is the ag. I mean, that's just remarkable. I mean, it's like I wish everybody in the United States and around the world will do a PhD on this to appreciate better the evidence and how bad this is and why scientists are so scared about this. You know, it's because when you look at the data and you study these cases, you realize how terrible this is. So as you point out, we are already heat up the planet by about 1 degree, and we found 2,000 heat waves since 1980 that had killed people. We found that 30% of the world's human population right now is exposed to deadly heat at least for 20 days a year. Now, what we are talking about is that if you fix climate change right now, the best we can, the Paris Agreement, even under the best-case scenario, you're still going to allow the planet to warm up by 1 degree more. So right now, even the most optimistic people in the world, when it comes to science, had agreed that the planet will still heat up by one more degree. So if you keep in mind that 30% of the world's human population is exposed to deadly heat already, imagine then what it will be when you allow the planet to warm up by one more degree. Of course, this is not to say that we shouldn't do anything, because if you don't do anything, then the planet will warm up by 4 and 5 degrees Celsius more, and that could be the end of it.
Indeed. I think people in industrialized countries remain confident that science and technology will protect them. They don't believe the electricity will go out for a month or two, as it did in Puerto Rico. They think the government will save us, or maybe the military. I feel like we're fooling ourselves in a really dangerous way.
Yes. So there is a psychological, actually this has been a story quite a lot, these psychological biases, that why is it that we don't take this more seriously? There is one of those biases that is called optimism bias. And basically what it points out is the fact that we normally, everybody thinks that bad things are happening. Obviously you see them on TV, on the news, and sometimes you might even see them, but you always think that that's just going to happen to somebody else. And that optimism bias is what is preventing people of taking action on climate change, because while we appreciate that might be bad, it's something that is going to influence somebody else. When it comes to me, then I will worry about it. Unfortunately, that optimism bias is just a matter of time until it eventually gets to you. And the example that I will give you is exactly what you are talking about, Puerto Rico, or the people in Texas, or the people in Florida that were struck, every one of those, by individual hurricanes this past summer season. This is a storm season. I bet that if you went to Texas a year ago, most of these people will tell you that climate change is just going to happen somewhere else. It was a matter of time until it came knocking at their doors, and now you lost billions of dollars on that estate. But thanks God there were not many lives lost, but the damages and costs were massive until eventually came and knocked at your door that climate change is real. So again, we live under this optimism bias that this is just going to happen to somebody else until eventually it gets to us. And at that moment, unfortunately, that optimism bias, unfortunately, what it's doing is delaying the solutions to fix this problem. And unfortunately, the longer we wait, the worse these things are going to be when they come.
So what are the next big questions for you, Camila Mora? What are you going to be working on?
So right now, as a scientist, I mean, you go and look at the science of this, we have thousands of scientists, hundreds of scientific papers pointing out how bad this is. Personally, I think that it got the time for us to investigate how to fix this problem. A lot of scientists are trying to tackle these solutions to this problem at the government level, which is okay, don't get me wrong. But then it's very fragile solutions, just like what you had in the United States here. For many years, we had President Obama, who is a person that say, yeah, we are going to try to fix this. But then out of the blue, we had a person like President Trump that says, I don't believe on this. And he just goes and closes all of the regulations in place to prevent this from happening. So personally, I don't think the solution is going to come from the government. I think personally, the solutions need to come from the people. People like you or me that start tackling this problem until it becomes a social norm in which every individual of our societies become aware of the footprint that we are having on our planet. And right now, that's one of the things that we are working hard on my lab, which is how do we ensure that people become aware of this footprint, the individual footprint, and what solutions are there so that every individual can clean up their footprint. Just like when you go to the beach, you produce garbage, but it's not like you're going to leave that garbage on the beach. You normally take it up and pick it up and put it on the garbage bin. So we want to do the same thing for climate change, that every individual, like you and me, we produce CO2. I'm figuring out the mechanisms for you to remove that CO2 from the air, not at the country level, not at the government level, but you as an individual. And that's one of the solutions that we are working on pretty hard on my lab.
We've been speaking with Dr. Camilo Mora from the University of Hawaii, Manoa. He is the lead author of a new paper published in the American Heart Association Journal, which is titled Circulation, Cardiovascular Quality, and Outcomes. The title is 27 Ways a Heat Wave Can Kill You, Deadly Heat in the Era of Climate Change. It is an open access paper, so you can search for that title or find the link in my show blog at ecoshock.org if you would like to read it. Camilo, thank you so much for providing this important science. We need it.
Thank you very much, Alex. A pleasure to be with you.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. That was a Radio EcoShock replay from November 2017. I will be back next week. Thank you for listening to Radio EcoShock during this pandemic and still caring about our future and about our children's future.